Paranormal Radio is the place to be, so join us at liveparanormal.com.
Yeah, that's awesome.
For joining us on History FM Radio on liveparanormal.com and history.fm. From paranormal to the unexplained history, it all happens here. Looking to enhance your radio experience?
Well, hello everybody. Welcome to Beyond Belief, the show that will bring you information that's different, thought-provoking, and just might stretch the limits of your believability quotient. I'm your host, Les Velez, and I'm also the co-founder of Opus, the Organization for Paranormal Understanding and Support. And you can see us on www.opus501.org. We're an organization to help people out there having paranormal experiences. Tonight, I have my second time, actually, in a row, because I think this guy is just really has some incredible information, Orion Johnson. And I'm going to read a little bit about his biography because it's a rather long biography, but I think it's extremely interesting. First of all, he became a member of two NASA astrobiological teams. Wrote and published a chapter describing the key concepts related to Earth biodiversity as pertaining to astrobiology for the NASA-supported astrobiology primer. He published a set of mathematical models explaining the simple requirements for sustainable community growth under very major energy and element limitations under the sun in a paper titled Continuous Culture, co-authored with Dutch Knight J. Gilles Kunen and in the Encyclopedia of Microbiology in 2009. He's been given, or he's actually been invited to talk at in astrobiology at the Carnegie Institute in Washington, the Chapman Conference on Deep Earth Physical Geology at Leiden University, the Netherlands, and the J. Craig Venter Institute, and have presented his PhD research in astrobiology at over 10 national and international conferences to a wide diversity of scientific audiences. So, without further ado, Orion, how are you? Good evening.
Yes, great. Thank you, Les. I'm really honored to be back again, and it's truly a privilege, and as we remarked last time, quite timely as we're heading into the famous date that is very soon approaching.
Absolutely. So tonight, what I wanted, Orion to talk about was this concept that he terms calls the Gemini Code, and it's absolutely fascinating. And so I think what we probably ought to do, Orion, is back up a little bit, give the audience a little bit of a background, and then get into the Gemini Code, because the last time we talked, we just ran out of time.
Exactly, yeah. And I think it was a little bit important since it was my first time speaking publicly about this information. And so to give some background information and to put that out into public record, I think was pretty essential. And now I can definitely do it in a much briefer way. Essentially, starting out as an undergrad up at UC Berkeley, I had the great honor of becoming an undergraduate assistant to Professor Bernard Nitschmann, who was really famous for pioneering a new type of geography that was known, called by him, new cartography. And what that meant was that geographers and scientists would basically, in a new model for publication of the research that they were doing, would come up with basically a simple rule that they would only go where they were invited, first of all, and where they would go, they would help the local people learn about research skills and cartography methods to basically map their own lands for their own use and their own self-determination. And that resulted in the publication of the Maya Atlas in 1998, which to me was during my undergrad. And I was so inspired by it, I basically joined the project and got to work in Central America for 2 years, including going through Belize to kind of follow up on that Maya Atlas project, which had started earlier in the 80s. And being really inspired by that, I kind of felt like I had found my career, but my professor sadly passed away of esophageal cancer and kind of didn't leave that as a real possibility. And so I ended up going and taking the lessons that I had learned from him in the field with this idea of new cartography and the science of basically empowering indigenous people as a way of empowering the environment itself, because where you go everywhere in the world and find indigenous people, you also find intact natural environment that's left, which is something quite rare on the surface of the planet. And so that was kind of the basic concept. And and amazingly enough, in the Maya Atlas that was published, you know, a lot of their traditions and their spiritual practices are recorded, and they're recorded for the world to see, you know, on record in their own words, through their own voices. And what they actually said was that, you know, they believe that, you know, men and women of high quality, I should say the mind and the soul of men and women of high quality can travel to celestial bodies to gain spiritual insight, during these spiritual ceremonies for times of significance, you know, times of need for the protection of the Maya is their philosophy, essentially.
Yeah,
and
you had something in your biography about the fact that you had been given a book called The Confessions of an Economic Hitman by your mother-in-law, and that you had gone to a seminar or a workshop and learned a little bit about shape-shifting into higher consciousness, which I thought was quite fascinating. So, I mean, this kind of all comes together for you.
That's what's so amazing about it to me, because it sort of actually, since we last spoke, I sort of looked back on my undergraduate research a little bit more and just sort of realized exactly how it was that the teachings of the Maya that had, you know, so inspired me to go down there in the first place, but then also kind of when my professor passed away, sort of pushed me into my next path, which was instead of going to work with him and continuing that specific work, it was to kind of go and end up working with the NASA guys, but along the way to go and make a bunch of monoclonal antibodies to a certain group of genes that we'll talk about in a second, which I did because of my desire to quantify pesticide residues around the plantations in the tropics, which was currently much too expensive to do on a basis where you know it would be feasible in the scope of a simple project. Mm-hmm. And so I'd kind of come up with a new method that would be cheaper and would kind of use all of my molecular skills combined with my cartographic skills and the concept of new cartography to basically empower the locals and get a little better insight about the processes going on in the environment and how big business is affecting it directly at a quantifiable level. And so basically what that led to is I made those death gene antibodies. And I knew when I made them that there was something weird about them, in that I had to basically activate them in order to test if my antibodies worked to the active form. And when I tried to activate these proteins, I realized that it was impossible to get a detection signal because the whole thing, it would disappear, it would dissolve itself. Like these were the really lethal end-stage effector genes that would essentially be the end game of life for any cell that they're activated in. And so when I was studying them, I basically was perplexed by the fact that they were named, you know, caspase 3-9 programmed cell death apoptosis genes, and it seemed like a weird name, and I just felt like the power of these genes was so significant, and they sculpt all of our tissues and our bodies and keep us healthy when they work properly. Essentially, they're very critical for our healthy functioning. and they had this funny name that I kind of was like almost inspired to apply to graduate school to work with. And then lo and behold, that didn't happen either. And so I ended up going and searching for life, working for years, realizing that there's a reality behind it. And that was the result of meeting this economic hitman and being compelled to look deeper into the reality of our world. And so when I did that, I started encountering a lot of opposition to this concept from a lot of old associates, you know, including my some family members, some friends, and especially my bosses at work, who did not want to look at data from Harvard, data from the NASA astronauts, data from the CIA directors, and so on and so forth, where I was suddenly feeling as if I had kind of been exploited on a really fun project that, you know, obviously I got to go travel the world giving talks and seeming like I was a really professional scientist in the astrobiology, searching for life and talking about how this is done and the science of it. But then feeling like it was all kind of a sham when I realized, well, actually these professionals that we've all honored and kind of heralded are speaking out behind the scenes but not making it onto the national stage. And then that kind of is exactly what happened to me too. And so I sort of became a protester. And as is the case many times in history, if you realize that, you know, people who kind of become fed up with the way things are and make a sacrifice and go look for spiritual wisdom, just as the Mayans say is possible. So I did. I went back to Mayaland with John Perkins, searching for the meaning of 2012 and working with the Mayan shaman in these ceremonies. I asked the shaman to guide the spirits to inform me, basically, you know, which genes would ETs use to engineer humans, if any. And that was my job as an astrobiologist, to sequence genomes and look for biosignatures related to how genomes affect the environment. And it was a complex job and it was a lot of work. And so I felt very sensitive about my censorship being levied upon me. And so, you know, I had those spiritual experiences that sort of made me trust that the spirit is capable of informing us of anything if you ask it in the right way. And you know, I had explained that earlier in the last time. And it's one of those things that came in such a calm and casual and simple voice, where the answer that I heard every time I asked this at these temples with a sincere heart was caspase 3, caspase 9. And at the time, it had been 10 years after I had even worked with these genes. I didn't remember that they were the programmed cell death apoptosis genes. But I was only intuitively aware that I needed to search in the H1N1 vaccine for those specific genes as the signature that I was looking for to kind of prove my point that I had been trying to make otherwise through the Harvard data and so forth. And so I sort of walked out of the Mayan forest and the Mayan temple sites, having traveled there, you know, for a couple of weeks with this team of shaman, sort of proudly saying, all you need to do is look in the H1N1 for caspase 3, caspase 9, and you'll have your ET biosignature. And I got my NASA director, boss, who I had just resigned from, to agree to do the experiment.
Well, let me ask you a question now. As far as the H1N1 thing, who came up with the H1N1?
The name itself?
Well, I mean, is this something that was created, or is this something that just came about? Or
so the way the H1N1 is named, it's technically the A/H1N1, and that's influenza A/H1N1. And H1N1 is a naming convention that's been applied to the influenza A, which uses the H and the N designation specifically for two genes that are present within the influenza. Now, the influenza has more than two genes.
Okay.
So to give it a designation based on these two genes is artificial right from the beginning.
Okay.
Now, what I can tell you is that the H is certainly something arguably logical, because H stands for hemagglutinin, which corresponds to the fact that the influenza is going to bind to the upper respiratory tract and to the red blood cells. And so, you know, its affinity for the heme of the red blood cells makes hemagglutinin, a good name for the H part of the H1N1 name.
Okay.
And there's one hemagglutinin gene within the H1N1. And the N is for neuraminidase. And that's a little bit fishy as far as I'm concerned, because there's nothing nothing really greatly logical about the name, because it actually cleaves the receptor, the binding site for the hemagglutinin, which is not a NeurAm, it's something different. And so, you know, I mean, you can argue about the name and everything, but basically, to just name the influenza A by those two genes, and then conveniently this code came out of it, you know, obviously could be intelligent or it could be random, and so could the whole universe at the ultimate level, couldn't it? And so you kind of have to look hard in order to see which one is right.
Okay.
And so what was kind of funny was basically that I had gone looking to see if this was something logical, if, you know, if these genes made any sense, and I came home and I Googled them, and I got, you know, the apoptosis programmed cell death genes, and my blood sort of boiled, and I knew that the secret presence of extraterrestrials being hidden, while it's reported by many, many top people around the world, is obviously not good for anybody, especially people who are professional searchers getting censored out of a job after working so hard. And
yeah.
So I felt like, okay, there's definitely a negative influence in general from the secret presence. And, well, you know, this message I got kind of confirmed that at a level that was shocking, astonishing, blood-boiling, and yet provable, because, you know, it was something that I had been closely associated with, having worked basically, you know, with the Mayans, with these genes, and with the top NASA guys, and then I got the agreement to do the experiment, and then that sort of resulted in my boss saying, oh, but I don't know how to do the experiment. And so on the 18th of December 2009, I wrote the Nobel laureate at MIT, who owns these genes, asking for help planning an unequivocal experiment to quantify the death genes in the H1N1 vaccine as an ET biosignature. And this is where everything went really wrong, because they basically said, we are not going to look, because a false positive is definitely going to be a problem.
Interesting.
And this idea is so far-fetched, it's only useful for science fiction. And so because the Nobel laureate and the NASA director and a Dutch knight all agreed, and they all agreed based on the Nobel laureate saying this, because the NASA director and the Dutch knight just took his word on it and disregarded what I was saying.
Yeah.
They basically said, okay, you know, go get your medication. You're wrong, because I had basically kind of trusted that I was right by my experiences with the shaman having been provably, measurably correct. And so in the first, you know, three journeys I had made with them, you know, 3 weeks of journeying with them and learning about this amazing spiritual force that's operating behind the scenes. And so when I sort of got this message, and it sort of tied everything together, and I could see that there was an obvious need to test the H1N1, I got the, you know, got the agreement to test it based on offering that if I was wrong, I would go get medical help and seek medication, because I think I'm right, and either I'm delusional or I'm correct.
Right.
And then there's, you know, one or the other. It's like it can't be both, because that's just the way it is, and we can measure it. And so they said, oh, you know, go get your medication. You can't be right. And if we look, we're going to find it. So we're not even going to do that. But, you know, because we agreed you're wrong, you're wrong. And they sent that out. But it was
so
even like...
What are the two genes now again? The cap what?
Caspase 3, Caspase 9.
Caspase.
Programmed cell death, apoptosis genes. So now here's the end result. It's crazy as hell, because, you know, I basically found the Gemini code based on sort of looking into the pattern associated between the winter solstice alignment and the concept that the caspase 3, caspase 9 would be numbered based on there being three alignments for 3 days after the winter solstice leading to Christmas, as kind of some secret formula that these people were using. And then when I mapped it, I was wrong. That was incorrect. But there was exactly what I had hypothesized mirrored across the solstice line, which led to a rich, very profound symmetry form that basically unifies the creation codes in the Bible, which are very mathematical. It embodies the geometric shape of the Bible itself, as discovered recently by Richard Magoe and published on BibleWheel.com and in his book, The Bible Wheel. And it basically embodies a very profound, tightly wrapped onion of mathematical form that is so perfectly constructed as to be impossible to have accidentally stumbled upon while searching for such a thing. But then kind of the end result, if you get into it, is that it's also the secret magic formula, the master key of all mysticism, as described by Aleister Crowley. And that's where I just kind of, you know, can kind of prove that this was not an accident, and that basically what is going on here is something very profound and very real that definitely deserves a lot of attention. And I think eventually we'll get it based on its self-evidence, but it deserves it based on, you know, this the mathematics of this code kind of proving it, but then the descriptions of the secret formulas being used by the mystery schools basically matching this code exactly. And what I'm referring to is the code that Crowley describes as the IAO formula, and that's the Isis Apophis Osiris formula. And that's what he says is basically, you know, the key to all forms of elementary mysticism. And if you get into it, it's the H1N1 and the apoptosis, because that's exactly the way the H1N1 is coded, where there's you know, there's an H plus one is I for Isis, and that's what Crowley says. The I is Isis, and the N plus one is O for Osiris, and Crowley says the O is Osiris, and the A is Apophis, who's this snake death demon, and that basically in the ultimate form, the I and the O form the opposites to create the field in which A operates. And so it's an advanced code, but it's very visibly real, as shown on the GeminiCode.com. And what's amazing is that I discovered it, mapped it based on this spiritual guidance from, you know, these Mayan ceremonies that had kind of projected me to, you know, to see something that I was searching for in a very kind of clear spiritual way, but then to ground truth it very carefully with my own intelligence and my own discernment and my own desire to be correct. You know, I loathe the thought that I would you know, hurt anybody by mistakenly giving out false information. Mm-hmm. And so when I received this message, you know, I carefully researched it to see if it made sense and was it a true spiritual message or was it some accident that, you know, I wouldn't really worry so much about. And yet it was a profound message that kind of tied so many things together in such a clear way that, you know, I was like, oh, wow, this is sort of real. And it didn't seem real in the sense that it didn't seem possible to me, because nothing like this had ever happened. I mean, I had always kind of ignored religion and spirituality at the level of active participation, always kind of interested and open-minded in it, you know, and I would say I've always been spiritual, but to have such a crazy real experience was something I didn't expect. And so that was where meeting the shaman was something obviously I went and did and was interested in enough to do it, but was as astonished and in as much disbelief as I think anybody would be.
So now here you are.
Find the things
here,
that I did.
Yeah, here you are. you've come to these conclusions, and you know, you, what's the next step for you? What does this, you know, make you feel and do as far as the next step?
Well, I think that that the world is going through a big awakening, and that the awakening is something that is being forced upon us and not just something that's kind of naturally happening. I think that if it was completely natural, it would happen much more slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that under the situation we're in, there's an awakening that's being forced upon us. And under the time of need, I think that we all sort of have a place in our spirit or in our heart or whatever, in our mind, wherever it is, that sort of responds to the call of the day. And sort of the call of the day now is to kind of, you know, raise up our spiritual power to kind of strengthen our minds to deal with something that we've never really thought we were ever going to have to deal with in this life. And what that is alien life detection and acknowledging that we're not alone and doing it as a human family. And basically, I think facing this challenge as a human family and starting to recognize the value of each person, even the lesser known sometimes, like, you know, like I've certainly become after being somebody who, you know, who was, you know, put in front of, you know, thousands of people on stage in Vienna in 2006, at which point, you know, I was really feeling blessed by the scientific achievements that I had been accomplishing, but only to realize later that was not the full story. And so what's next is to try to win back what I had before to the level that I had it.
Right.
But also to not burn the bridges that I've kind of sacrificed, if you will. I'm trying to rebuild those and trying to reform the bridges with the academics and to kind of like help humanity unite on a big challenge. And I think that the scientists have so much knowledge that is of a spiritual nature, and yet they won't acknowledge that spirituality and, you know, anything you might call God actually would mm-hmm. be measurably real. And so that's sort of something that I think maybe should be overcome based on the experiences that a lot of people are having these days that are measurably real, mine only being one. And so I'm trying to kind of win back my old science reputation. I don't know if that's really possible. I think that would be ideal. I think that's where I belong.
Mm-hmm.
And then also preparing for a changing world, because what I think is that there's going to be sort of this awakening, and the awakening is basically kind of the result of the hemisphere shift that's occurring between the four cardinal directions and their orientation relative to the galactic center. And so if you can imagine that the galactic center, this solstice, is exactly in line with the Earth and the Sun on the solstice, right? So the winter solstice is touching the galactic center. So that's something that only happens once every 24,000 years, it turns out. And so I kind of mentioned that number is very accurate.
And it's
based
amazing
on the timely arrival.
It's amazing.
Excuse
that
me?
The Mayans understood that.
It is amazing. And so that's where the Gemini Code is something that's kind of, it's reflected in a lot of these religious institutions throughout history, in their symbolism and in their scripture in various forms. And you see it.
Right.
And what
let's hold right there for a second. I got to do a break here, and then we'll come back. I want to talk about that some more. I want to talk about how you personally are going to proceed with this knowledge, and what, you know, the rest of us should be doing based on what you found out. So, ladies and gentlemen, just hang in there. We're going to be back here in about a minute, and look forward to talking again to Orion Johnson and the Gemini Code.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on History FM Radio on liveparanormal.com and history.fm. From paranormal to the unexplained history, it all happens here. Looking to enhance your radio experience? Participate in live interactive chat 24/7 with our radio show hosts and other like-minded people on www.liveparanormal.com, the only interactive social chat room supported by full interactive media. Stop by now and join in on the fun.
Yeah, hey everybody, we're back. Tonight we have Orion Johnson with us, formerly of NASA, and we're talking about the Gemini Code. Very interesting perspective on a code that he's found embedded in some of the Mayan I don't want to say scriptures because they don't have any, but in talking to the shamans Mayan shamans that are still out there, he's found out some very interesting things. Orion, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great, thanks, Les.
And
it's a real joy to be here, and this is, you know, this is definitely a code that is perfectly reflected in the legends of the Maya as well as in the calendar. And so that's the thing about it. What I've realized is that there's simply a master key to kind of the earth. And it's something that it's so profound as to be incomprehensible, even to me, who has been working on this for, quite a long time. Like I said, this spiritual insights look started in 2009. I actually started mapping it deeply after the lunar eclipse in 2010, where I had a very good calibration point to get the exact position of the sun and the earth on the solstice. And then from there, it was a piece of cake, because with those calibration points, it was just a simple matter of triangulation and careful positioning, and then doing the mathematics of the motions, and then starting to see that there's a real pattern here, and it's amazing, and it's geometric. And lo and behold, it's embedded within our holy scriptures all throughout world history, our architecture throughout world history, our calendars throughout world history. And what they've done is they've secretly removed a couple of hidden pieces of information that are the big keys that show how it's all connected, and what those keys are. I've put on the Gemini Code as sort of a way that people can see how this is really one pattern that's being replayed over and over. And the basic pattern is basically the design form of creation, as I'm hypothesizing. And it's based on this idea of sacred geometry and sort of a circle being something infinite as a mathematical concept.
Mm-hmm.
And so kind of the weave of creation is based on that, it turns out, and the sort of the numbers associated with that take a natural form that has sort of a radiant beauty that I'm hypothesizing has been intelligently selected and designed to...
I understand, you've got a scientific background, and
I can explain anything.
Some of our listeners, we need to ratchet it down a little bit here and try to put it out there in a way that, okay, you found this quote unquote code, all right? And what exactly is this code doing?
So what this code is doing is several things at once, and it's primarily doing three things simultaneously. The first thing it's doing is it's providing a map to the galactic center as sort of the heart of our universe. It's the most unmovable place in our sky. And so by anchoring your awareness to the galactic center, you're sort of focusing your awareness into the most unmovable part of creation. And as a spiritual concept, that's a very powerful thing. As a scientific concept, it's also a very useful thing. As a practical geographic concept, it's very useful.
Okay.
And like I said last time with this concept of new cartography, I was trained as an undergrad to know that more land has been won through mapping than through war over the history of the world. And
that
so
was
kind of
fascinating
think,
when you said that last time you were on. When I heard that, it was like, are you kidding me?
Right. And then you start to realize the power of cartography and mapping.
Yeah.
And influence and persuasion, and how preferable these are to military force whenever it's possible.
Right.
And so here a map to the galactic center is a very powerful map because, well, that really is the whole pie. And it also is a map to its opposite. And so its opposite turns out to be the Orion constellation. And that's what's a very weird and useful coincidence because it's so prominent in the sky. And the association of the Orion constellation with that really bright star Sirius, also a reflection of Isis, is something that is our key indicators, you know, and key anchors of basically, you know, stellar navigation. And this is something throughout history. But Sirius is so close that it moves quickly relative to the three stars of Orion's belt. And so those, being relatively distant and very bright, have provided incredibly useful anchor points for mm-hmm. basically sort of charting the rate of orbit of the Earth around the Sun and the rate of spin of the Earth, which is what this code is doing. So it's sort of basically giving a clock that instructs a map to the galactic center, its opposite as Orion, and then those two things are basically what are known as the wands of Horus, who is the sun in between. And so the idea of Horus holding on to these wands is basically, you know, it's like the two arms of a clock. And so it's the grounding point. And from there, what becomes really clear is that the timely arrival of the winter solstice to this exact bullseye hit in the middle of this phenomenon in 2012 essentially proves that the teachings of Swami Sri Yukteswar in his book, The Holy Science, are accurate when he was explaining that during the Dark Ages, the Yuga calendar was basically convoluted and that it's always been 24,000 years broken up into a very clear pattern that has a very high degree of symmetry. And so he basically diagram this out, and by mapping using that information and anchoring it to the instructed star that he provided as the ancient spike of the zodiac, the fixed star Spica, that's where the Gemini code manifests so clearly, where you realize that, oh, the galactic center opposite Orion manifests exactly at 22 degrees below and above the zodiac horizon. And there's this seven-day symmetry event on both sides, and that's where 22 over 7 across 22 over 7, which is literally 22 degrees and 7 degrees, and so there's a connection between the days and the degrees as well, showing kind of the concept of how our mathematical system came into being. That's where the idea of pi over pi making the Gemini symbol fell into place for me, and I started to realize that, oh, that's where the idea of Gemini is Isis and Osiris, and it's pi over pi, and it's a real clear pattern with the 2012 alignment, where the winter solstice is really dividing it and sort of aligning to it. And that's a calibrated clock if I've ever seen one, because it's dead on accurate as prophesied thousands of years ago. And it fits these legends. And furthermore, if you remember the legend of Osiris, there's 14 parts that he was divided into. And so if you then imagine that in the 14 sign, what I call the Gemini calendar, there's seven signs that are towards the galactic center, and there's seven signs that are away from the galactic center. And so that division line at this time is the equinox boundary. So right now there's this perfect balance between what I would call the house of Isis and the house of Osiris, which are basically the towers that form the anchors for this Gemini calendar, and also the famous wands of Horus, which legendarily were the key to the construction of the pyramids and to the chasing away of Apophis in the legend. And so this is all something that exactly fits basically the claims of Crowley as something deceptive and my own spiritual experience as something very truthful and honest and urgently in need of a serious investigation at the very least.
I mean, you know, you think about the fact that what the Mayans knew and what the Egyptians knew, and how could they possibly understand these concepts, these realities, without some kind of outside influence?
Well, that's the amazing thing that I've only hinted about on this Gemini code. But what the amazing sort of realization is, and I had the privilege of making this thanks to the teachings of Lynn Roberts and John Perkins, who basically really manifested this spiritual presence beyond anything I could have ever imagined, and helped me find my own so easily as a result, where it's in your heart, and the teachings of these yogis as well is explaining that if you learn to look inside, there's the secret door, and it's, you know, there's actually, according to Paramahansa Yogananda, there's even a biological structure called the medulla oblongata, mm-hmm. which is the seat of the soul, and it's, you know, it's in there near the pineal gland, but
right.
But this is apparently a very delicate structure that has sort of a focal point of our consciousness that we can pass through with our soul, just like the Mayans say, to go and basically connect with this omniscient spirit. And that's where I was kind of forced to sort of believe that there's a reality to it when I was getting information that was dead on accurate in my first shamanic experiences. And then when I took it seriously.
Yeah. So you're saying that they're doing this spiritually as opposed to actually, let's say, some craft coming down and physically interacting with the Mayans or the Egyptians?
Well, it's a little bit of both, isn't it? And that's kind of the great thing. And that's kind of like, look at my experience. I didn't have a craft come down and mm-hmm. and give me a code. Mm-hmm. Crowley says he talked to God through a spiritual message during a trip to Egypt, and was given this information that he wrote down as the Book of Law in three chapters over 3 days that became his religion, including the IAO formula, which is also part of Freemasonry, which means it's actually ancient. And, well, it wasn't really new. And so what's the truth, Crowley? Like, if you got it and you're a prophet and it's actually ancient knowledge, well, what's going on really, you know? And lo and behold, he was prophesying that this would be the dawn of the Aeon of Horus. And that it's, you know, it's all about the IAO formula. And so, you know, there's just this exactitude in his message that he got and my message that I got. And so the thing is that I'm not in a secret society, and I'm not connected with them, and I'm not keeping secrets, and I'm trying to reveal the need to investigate and get out into the public's awareness that secret societies might be a big threat and that extraterrestrials are real and their secret presence is certainly not good at the very least and likely very bad. And I'm proposing that it's horrible at the moment. And but yet, through history, I think that it's been a mixed bag. I think that if you go back into what would be the last golden age, according to the Yuga calendar, that's deconvoluted, which would, you know, basically be something like 13,000 years ago, plus a little bit of change, but certainly you'll be in there. I think that there were likely also relationships with very benevolent extraterrestrials that were rich, and there's evidence for that in many places around the world. And so, you know, that's my hypothesis. Obviously, this is something very hard to know for certain, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
I know.
I mean,
and so,
it's the kind of thing that just drives people crazy. I mean, you know, I very often get frustrated with the MUFON organization, the Mutual UFO Network, because, you know, they send out investigators and we talk to people, and the fact that they, you know, sort of a nuts and bolts type of an organization, and they look at photographs that people have taken, and you know what, we have not progressed since 1947. You know, when supposedly a UFO crashed at Roswell, I don't think we've progressed at all since that time in understanding this whole phenomena. I think the spiritual aspects, what you're talking about, are where we're going to learn more and gain a better understanding of what the heck this is all about. And it's a process. I think it's an evolutionary process that we're going through, and that this particular plane that we exist in at the moment is experiencing this phenomena, and that there's many, many other dimensions that have already progressed past this, and maybe they're the ones that are interacting with us and helping us along, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if you can imagine the cosmos is filled with so many, so many, so many billions of these giant galaxies, and how many civilizations have come and gone already in the cosmic process, and
right,
yet how many more will come and go in the process.
Exactly.
And so I think kind of the grand realization is that life is really awesome. And it's really abundant in the universe. And that's just part of nature.
Mm-hmm.
And it's obviously sort of arrogant to think that we're the only ones that got to be here or get to be here or that might want to be here or might be interested in this beautiful place. And you know, and so that is the case, it turns out. And we're at sort of a time of awakening where that's going to be reality forever forward at a certain point.
Exactly.
And I think that point is pretty close myself. And I think
let me just say that we've got about 7 minutes.
Yeah,
so
I get it.
We don't want to get cut off like we did the last time.
Not at all. No, we're not going to. And I think that there is one thing that I would like to emphasize about this code regarding its fundamental three roles that I didn't finish earlier.
Okay.
Sort of wandered off on that one. And so the fundamental three roles is it's a map to the galactic center and its opposite as sort of a clock that the Earth manifests related to the rotation.
Mm-hmm.
And that rotation is, you know, 24-hour day mirrored by 24,000-year rate of precession. And so that those numbers are an amazing perfect match that the Earth manifests. So that's the first thing it does. As a map to the galactic center, gives us a nice clock that the Earth manifests for us that, you know, drives the zodiac pattern. And the other thing it does is it has a secret formula that instructs cosmic creation, as I mentioned earlier. And so this actually gives instructions for the Om in the symbols for, you know, Cancer and Gemini aligning across this boundary opposite Ophiuchus as a mathematical equation. And then there's a further equation made evident by the Isis and Osiris symbols. that I put on GeminiCode.com. I don't want to explain them on the radio because,
okay,
like you said, it's not gonna mean much just to hear numbers being given out, like a telephone number or something.
Give that website address.
It's thegeminicode.com with the Gemini Code, and it's there it's shown pretty clearly how this stuff is really beautiful mathematics that is higher order symmetry that truly kind of reflects what you see when you look out in the stars and you realize it's kind of spiraling out, and it's got these polar opposites, and it's basically coming down to a simple concept. And what that concept is that basically the light minus the dark is the sacred vibration called the ohm. And that has the value of 3 to the 6th, which is where the sign of the beast is, 666, is actually 729, which is 3 to the 6th, or this other number that 1690 minus 961. It's a mirror. It's a higher mirror. And it's beautiful if you write it out. But if you start to realize that creation is all taking the form of opposites and attraction and repulsion, and that's where it's kind of like the Gemini, where it's like the idea of the lovers is also a reflection of these opposites, but so is the light and the dark. And so that map showing this light and the dark as the sacred fundamental quantum vibration of the universe times the 7 days of creation and the 7 lokas in Hinduism basically gives you what is known as alpha, or the cosmic fine structure constant, which I've called the cosmic sacred vibration. So it's giving basically a code to, I'm saying, all the forces of nature. The atomic forces are embedded here. And that's where I think when the physicists really start getting into what's going on and how useful this information and this map are and this Gemini code are, there's going to be a major awakening happening. And I think that secretly holding this information in some vault is a crime against humanity, personally. And I think that bringing it out is a gift, and that's what I'm trying to do. And I had a gift of mathematical training from some of these great scientists that I think they will be honored for, even if they don't want to take credit for it. And Thijs Kuenen, my Dutch professor, is so dear in my heart, and this guy really did train me in the concepts of growth and sustainable growth at a level that really takes it to, like,
well,
you know.
When you talk about the sacred formulas for cosmic creation, I mean, that's huge.
It's huge, but it's what's been, it's unbelievable that this code would have matched it, though. And that's where it's like, okay, when I made that error about my original hypothesis and these 3 stars, 3 alignments, and then the error actually led to the symmetry form that, by Googling the numbers, I got the BibleWheel.com, and in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and there was an exact fit with all the dimensions of the equation. It was like, okay, could that have been an accident, or is this intelligent? And then you realize, oh, this is all intelligent. And it's really profoundly intelligent, and the code is really profound.
Can we make a jump in logic here to say that understanding this sacred formula for cosmic creation, that we could actually utilize it in some way, shape, or form?
That's the second thing the map is doing. It's giving us that opportunity.
Wow, that's really big.
Exactly. And so the final thing the map is doing is it's empowering the conspirators to think that they can get away with all this. Because the power of the knowledge is so richly powerful, like as I've now explained. And so by having the map to the galactic center, the map to cosmic creation, and then the secret of these things, that's the inspiration for the conspirators. And so by bringing that information out into the public, you basically disempower the conspirators and you empower the good people.
Right.
And that changes the whole game. And that's where it's like, this is a really powerful code. It is the master key. Crowley made that clear. And I was guided by the Mayans because I had a good heart. I was down there trying to help the Mayans chart their own destiny as my undergrad work, and I would have kept doing that. And excuse me, it was that work was published as I started the work, so I only followed up on that. I wasn't part of that publication, and nor was my professor a co-author on that. He was only there to teach them how to do it themselves, you know, so it really wasn't about getting credit ourselves, more about
right.
it getting done, like the good work
yeah.
needs to get done. It doesn't matter if you're,
you know what? I think I'm going to have you back again.
Right on.
I tell you, you know, this is absolutely fascinating. I think, you know, we're just hitting the tip of the iceberg, as it were. And unfortunately, we're at the end of our show here tonight. And I want to thank you very much. I'll certainly be in touch. I want to thank you for your time, the last show and this show, and just absolutely fascinating information. And hope you'll be back again sometime in the near future. I'll certainly be contacting you. And I want to thank everybody out there for listening in. And you've been listening to Beyond Belief with Les Velez here. If you have a paranormal happening in your life and you're looking for some help, you can contact us at Opus at www.opus501.org. We're there to help. So, again, thank you, Orion, and thank you, everybody, and have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year and a Happy Hanukkah as well. So take care.
Thank you so much, Les. It's really been an honor being here with you, and I would be happy to come back whenever you invite me.
All right. You got it, Orion. Thanks again. Take care.
All the best.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us on History FM Radio on liveparanormal.com and history.fm. From paranormal to the unexplained history, it all happens here. Looking to enhance your radio experience? Participate in live interactive chat 24/7 with our radio show hosts and other like-minded people on www.liveparanormal.com, the only interactive social chat room supported by Full Interactive Media. Stop by now and join in on the fun.